Attic. My name is Bailey Moore, and I have here with me...
Eric Dumig, the only producer. Finger guns. We're finger gunning. For those in the audience who aren't seeing our faces on the Zoom screens, we're finger gunning all over the place.
Over here and over there. And pew, 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 pew. And this is a mini episode, the second part of a two-part series on the short films of Tim Burton made for Disney before he set off on his career as a feature film director. So how are you doing, Eric?
I'm doing great. You know, I gotta tell you, I'm really loving the pace of my life these days. You know, I haven't been working at all, at least not like a job for money, you know, kind of thing. I've been working on stuff, and in fact, I'm more busy during the pandemic than I was before. Way more busy doing stuff every day, but I'm so just like in a rhythm that is very aligned with the kind of pace and rhythm that I like to get into in long stretches between times of working for money or like having to be somewhere because somebody's paying me to be there. There's something about that. Like even like my day job is working in the film industry and going on set and recording the sound while the camera is rolling. And I love that job. I think it's a great job. And I super love the whole craft of filmmaking and the sound department is great and I love doing it. But there's something about having to be somewhere to make money that it just makes me feel weird in a certain kind of way. It's like, oh, I have to do this thing and there's this transactional nature to it.
You're dependent on it.
Yeah, totally. It's like how I pay my rent or whatever. And there's always some like low level hum of anxiety about those times. But in being freelance in years prior, in these times between going on set, if I had like a long stretch, like 2 weeks or more without being on set, then I would be able to drift into these modes, these kind of rhythms where I'm really just kind of going in my own flow, right? And now I just get to do that all the time, like because I'm just on unemployment and the film industry is probably not coming back anytime soon. So yeah, I'm just like kind of in that mode all the time now. And it's not just like goofing off. It's like I'm spending this time doing exactly the kind of research and following different pathways and working on stuff that I believe in, you know, like work with the Tea House and stuff that I've been doing during the pandemic. And just all these things are kind of aligning to allow me to kind of just like move in my flow. And so I'm really grateful for that time period right now.
Honestly. That's good. And it's really good to see you.
Yeah, likewise. It's great to get to hang out. We haven't hung out in like a couple weeks. So
yeah.
It's been a minute.
What's one of the most interesting things that you've discovered recently?
Oh, man. I'll go with this because it's the first thing that popped into my head. The I Ching, the Chinese divination system and it's something that I've kind of like dipped my toes in before because I like these kinds of things. Like I like tarot cards and astrology and the Enneagram and the various systems for discussing like self-discovery or self-actualization or giving a landscape view of the present in such a way that you can kind of determine your possible futures, things of that nature, like super vibe with me in kind of the Venn diagram of my other interests being China and Chinese tea and East Asian culture. I recently picked up a translation of the I Ching by Alfred Huang, which I really like. I like this translation a lot, and I've just started like kind of messing around with it, and I'm using colored pencils instead of yarrow stalks because I don't have yarrow stalks where I live, but I do have colored pencils where I live. I've been using those, and it's been fun. It's been really fun to just kind of mess around with a new system, you know?
That's fascinating. I don't really know anything about that.
It's neat. In a similar way to like the, you know how the major arcana in tarot, all the like archetype cards like kind of tell a story of the kind of seasons of existence based on these kind of very strong archetypes. The I Ching does the same thing, but there's more of them. I would say there's a lot different nuance to the kind of story that it tells. I will say the tarot, while it does have its kind of ups and downs, it seems there's a kind of ultimateness to the end that kind of makes it feel a little bit more linear. Mm-hmm. Whereas the I Ching, it's just like a sine wave. It literally is like as high as you can go, and then it just goes right back down, and then goes back to as high as you can get it right back down. You're constantly just like turning over on these things. And so there will be symbols that are really, really auspicious, like time to go. And then other ones that are like really inauspicious, like if you move even 1 foot, you will probably experience deep regret. So you should probably just stay where you are. It's so fun to like see how they lay it out, because it is in an order, which is neat. And all of them relate to each other. I'm such a nerd about systems and things like
this. Oh, it's really interesting. I picked up a book once in Ireland on numerology.
Sweet.
And I started reading through that. And it's really funny. I was not in a very good state of mind at that time. And I figured out what, like the number that has corresponded to my name and what that said about me. And then I did it for my siblings. And like, it showed me that I was the least remarkable of all of my siblings. And I just sat in the room and cried.
Just bluntly said that.
Well, I mean, the numbers.
Ouch. The yeah. numbers be dragging you, Bailey.
The numbers sucks. Always are dragging me. Okay, so the reason why we're here recording.
That's right.
Like I mentioned before, this is not going to be a regular memory static episode. Until I can find a way to safely continue with the regular formula of memory static, I'll be sticking to these new mini episodes. And the main differences are they're going to be much, much shorter. There's sadly no use for the slow-moving time machine during the pandemic. It's impossible to social distance in the time machine.
It's very small in there.
Yeah, it's pretty small and a lot of recycled air.
Yeah.
These episodes are not going to feature a particular guest that's chosen a specific movie. And because of that, naturally, there won't be as big of a concentration on childhood memories, but they will naturally come up, I'm sure. And finally, there will not be an original song at the end of these episodes. My brother Cullen and I normally work together, and with the pandemic restrictions, it's just too difficult for us to do that right now. But that doesn't mean that it's not going to be fun, and it's just going to be different.
Yeah, let's keep it easy on ourselves, you know? It's quarantine season. Let's not, right. We don't need to make it any harder than it already is.
No, not at all.
No.
All right, so in the last episode, I may or may not have said this would be a three-part miniseries, but I decided to make it two instead. I decided to skip the Hansel and Gretel Halloween special. I'll be talking about it a little bit, but we're going to skip ahead to Tim Burton's third and final short film before leaving Disney, the original Frankenweenie. Now, you've watched it.
I have.
Had you seen it before?
You know, I think I have, but it was a really long time ago. That I can't remember, but so much of the imagery is like very familiar that I feel like I must have at some point as a kid.
Well, what did you think? It's an interesting movie.
The original? What I think? Oh man, I have so many thoughts. There's lots going on there. I will say, interesting to see Tim Burton riff on like the Leave It to Beaver kind of like suburban mm-hmm. area without like his main character is really like good looking, like very Hollywoody kid, you know?
Yeah.
And he looks like Steven Spielberg cast him. And like the parents, like, I love Shelley Duvall. She's great. But like the dad look, this is a weird thing. The dad looks like he's about to start laughing like the whole movie. Like, the whole movie, he's just got this like shit eating grin on his face. Like he's about to burst into laughter and they cut right before that happened every shot, you know?
That's so funny. I didn't really pick up on that, but
it's got this goofy smile. It's super weird.
We will talk more about our general thoughts when we have the Zoom party later on with lots of familiar voices from other episodes. Mm-hmm. So the last episode was about the short motion, the stop motion animated short Vincent, which mm-hmm. was pretty fun.
He named his kid Vincent again in this one.
Yes. No. His name is Victor.
Or Victor. It's Victor. Right. It's Victor.
Yeah, but as very,
similar
very close.
Name.
Yeah.
He likes that V name. There's definitely a theme here developing.
Yes, there is. So to pick up where we left off, Vincent had gotten some positive attention. And because of that, Tim Burton was able to secure a small budget for a Halloween special. And It is a uniquely original and bizarre adaptation of Hansel and Gretel, which is one of my favorite fairy tales. And it doesn't surprise me that Tim Burton wanted to do an adaptation of Hansel and Gretel because it is one of the darkest fairy tales.
Certainly suits his sentiments.
Yeah, absolutely. So it aired only one time on Halloween on the newly established Disney Channel in 1983. And despite it being scheduled to air again, it was promptly pulled and shelved, likely because it was so weird and disturbing. You can find it on YouTube. It's available. We're not going to really be concentrating on much, but if you're curious, it's there. So it was so obscure that most people believed that it had been a rumor and didn't actually exist, which to me, like, I feel like that's just more fuel for the Mandela effect.
Oh yeah, right.
Like, can you imagine if you caught that in 1983 on Halloween night and then never ever saw it again until 2009?
That's when they released it from the Disney vault?
Yeah, it was released to exhibit in a museum.
Oh, whoa, cool.
Yeah. Until that time, like, you probably had all these conversations with people like, I know I saw this thing. And everybody's like, no, that's not real. That didn't exist.
Doesn't exist, yeah.
So anyway, 2009, it was exhibited in a museum. And I could not find information confirming this, but this is pure conjecture. But I think that it is likely that before Hansel and Gretel aired, Tim Burton had gotten the green light on his next project, which was Frankenweenie. He had approached with a storyboard the then Disney production chief Richard Berger, who loved the idea. And the idea for Frankenweenie was inspired by a combination of a rewatch of the old Universal Frankenstein and the memories of Tim Burton's own beloved childhood dog. Have you ever seen the Universal Monster movies?
I don't think so. Original Frankenstein or anything? Mm-hmm, like, mm-hmm. Nah.
Well, I would highly recommend Frankenstein and Bride of Frankenstein. Bride of Frankenstein is better. I love the sequel. But you'll see, like, direct inspiration between mm-hmm. the two. Just in, like, the choice to make it black and white, the painted skies and mm-hmm. stuff like that.
Yeah, you could tell he has a lot of reverence for old Hollywood, you know? Like, there's even a line right at the beginning where they're all watching the home movie and the dad says something like, my son's gonna the next Hitchcock or something like that. He's got this very strong, like, nostalgia for 50s and 60s Hollywood, it seems. 40s, 50s, 60s Hollywood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I would recommend it, but Bride of Frankenstein even more. So this is really cool. They were actually able to get the original laboratory set pieces from the 1930s Frankenstein for Frankenweenie, which was also used in Young Frankenstein.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Look at that. That's awesome.
Okay, so they had about 2 weeks of pre-production. The short was shot in 15 days with about 2 months of post-production, and they did it all with a budget of $1 million. So in your experience working in the film industry, is that a reasonable budget for a short film?
Sure.
Sure?
Yeah. Okay. I think given what they made, yeah, I think that sounds about right. 15 days is actually nice and long for something that's only 30 minutes. I mean, there's movies that are 2 hours long now that are shot in 15 days. Hell, there's episodes of television that are shot in a week. So production schedules have really ramped up. I mean, obviously technology was different in the 80s and things had to move a little slower. Mm-hmm. And there was a little bit more understanding about that. But that seems pretty reasonable. I mean, even like kind of high for that time period for something short and with name talent. Like at that point, Shelley Duvall was someone who was recognizable, you mm-hmm. know?
Right. So let's talk a little bit about the cast, because mm-hmm. Shelley Duvall is probably the most famous person in this short, but there are other familiar faces. Mm-hmm. So we have Daniel Stern, who plays the dad. We probably know him from Home Alone. He's right. One of the thieves in Home Alone. And then Barrett Oliver, who is the kid in The Neverending Story. He's the one that plays Victor.
Oh, that's right. Oh, wow. It is Neverending Story, huh?
And then there's a small role together. Played by Jason Hervey, who plays Wayne Arnold in The Wonder Years. He's the kid that comes over to play. You only see him for a second.
Oh, he's the kid.
So, I mean, there are a couple other people. I recognize them, but I didn't know what they were from specifically. But the crazy thing is that many of the cast members, if not all of them, did it because they wanted to, and they didn't get paid.
Whoa, really?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's one way to keep it to $1 million.
Right. That's why I was curious what you had to say about it. Because I feel like a lot of money must have gone into
set special effects.
Like the sets, because the sets are pretty detailed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Frankenweenie was scheduled to screen as a featurette before the re-release of Pinocchio, which Tim Burton was thrilled about because he really loved Pinocchio. And if you think about it, Pinocchio has some really dark elements to it.
Yeah. It's one of the creepiest Disney movies of all time.
Extremely creepy. But after some pre-screenings with families, some moms voiced concerns that they were afraid it would encourage their children to play with electricity. Moms.
They're just... Are those the same moms that were getting into like the video games are bad conversation in the 90s when
probably.
I started playing
they were probably the
shooter
same
video
moms.
Games on Nintendo? Those moms. They're just quit being a buzzkill, moms.
Right. So because of that, it resulted in Frankenweenie being given a PG rating.
I'm trying to learn about electricity, Mom.
Right, Mom.
This is part of my education. You see all these simple machines I'm using to like prop up our roof?
Yeah, how am I going to know how to bring back my pets?
Yeah, exactly.
Mom.
Mom.
So the PG rating meant that it could no longer screen with Pinocchio, which was rated G.
Oh.
Which like Tim Burton was like, why? Like, what is it in Pinocchio that makes it a G? So other than a very limited release in LA to have it qualify for Oscar consideration and a small release in the UK with Touchstone's Baby, Secret of the Lost Legend, just like Vincent and Hansel and Gretel, Frankenweenie was shelved with very few people having seen it.
Wow.
So by this point, the romance between Tim Burton and Disney had soured on both sides.
Burton, I would imagine.
Yeah, right? So Tim Burton felt frustrated that he had put all his creative energies in these projects to have nothing come of them. And Disney seeming to not even give them a chance. And Disney was tired of what they felt was a waste of funds on content that wasn't appropriate for their target audience.
Eye roll, Disney.
Major eye roll. Mom.
Mom.
So Tim Burton was fired.
He was fired. He didn't even get a chance to quit. He's like, all right, frustrating, and then they can me. Yeah. Oh, man, that stinks.
Yeah, right? But we know that wasn't the end for Tim Burton.
No, clearly not.
Fortunately, even with Frankenweenie's very limited screening, a few of the right people saw it, which is, you know, one of those age-old stories of success. Just happened to bump into the right people. One of those people was Stephen King, who recommended Frankenweenie to an executive at Warner Brothers, who recommended it to Paul Reubens, who had been looking for a director for his brainchild, Pee-wee's Big Adventure.
Whoa.
Which was Tim Burton's first feature film as a director.
Was it really?
Yes.
Pee-wee's Big Adventure, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, apparently they met and just bonded immediately, which makes total sense.
Oh, I believe it for sure.
So after Tim Burton gained fame from a few feature films, Disney released Frankenweenie on VHS in 1992. But I remember watching it on Disney Channel, and I was probably the target audience. You know, I was in first or second grade, and I loved it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's so engaging, the idea that you could just like see your like second grade teacher give like a short demo on electricity with a frog, and that suddenly within a night or two of like studying hard you could learn how to bring an animal back to life. I mean, that's an exciting proposition about education,
right?
That really makes you feel like the world's your oyster.
Yeah. Well, that's all I have. So,
hey,
like,
awesome. Fascinating. A lot of good information there. I feel like I've learned a lot about Tim Burton and about his time at Disney. What a time.
Well, you know, it's interesting to see like how someone starts, the little seeds that they start planting, and he just planted them in the wrong garden.
Yeah, the wrong garden first, and then, you know, grew a forest.
Right. Yeah. You want to see what everybody else to say? What everybody see, else
has, to, has say. To say. So we're gonna open the floodgates and get the whole team in here.
Yes.
Cool.
Hi, I'm Bailey.
And I'm Chaney.
And we're sisters.
And we're here to tell you about our brand new podcast called Two Sisters Present America's Sweethearts.
It is a comedy podcast that celebrates women in film by exploring their catalog of work. Each five-part series will feature a different woman working in the film industry.
We both will draw two genres at random, so four genres altogether.
Then, each episode will alternate who picks the movie based on one of the genres that we've drawn.
We'll watch the movie and then we'll talk about it along with fun facts about our featured sweetheart.
Oh, and the fifth episode of each series is Listener's Choice.
That's you.
I think that about covers it.
That's what the script says.
Great.
So stay tuned.
We'll be coming to your favorite podcast platform soon.
Bye.
So here we are at our Frank and Weenie Zoom party. Thank you all for coming.
Boom. Good to be here.
So just to introduce everybody, we have Haley Clement from The Adventures of Baron Munchausen.
Hi.
Chaney Moore from The Frog Prince.
Hello.
We have Kate Windsor from The Phantom Toll Booth. And Adam Sweeney from The Peanut Butter Solution. Sean Stone from Mr. Boogity.
Hold on, Mr. Boogity and
Bride of Boogity.
The Bride of Boogity.
Right.
It was a double feature.
Our double feature.
Thank you for correcting me, because that's good. Always do that. Cullen Moore, who writes all of the music for Memory Static. And then we have El Cuddy from The Lost Boys. And also Eric Dumig is still here.
After all these years,
so much praise.
Still here.
So much praise, Eric.
Eric did the initial part with me. So thank you all for being here. I'm really glad that y'all took this time. Had any of y'all ever seen this before?
A long time ago. I actually thought that this was a full-length feature. From watching it as a kid, I remember it being a full movie. So when I pulled it up today and it said it was a short, I was shocked.
You know, I thought it was much longer too, watching it as a kid. But you know, we don't have really a good sense of time as children.
Yeah, remember when like an hour was so long when you were little?
I was just going to say, I guess a half an hour or an hour, any delineation of time is a much larger fractional portion of your life when you're that small, you know?
Absolutely. There's a chance that I did see it when I was younger. And it seems like when I watched it in 2012, everything seems so familiar. But I wasn't 100% sure. I didn't get to see it maybe as a young child, but I definitely have seen it quite a bit of time since.
Well, that's great.
2012. Yeah.
So most of y'all, this was your first time ever seeing it.
Yeah.
What were some of your favorite parts?
When I finally made the realization that the little boy was the little boy from Never Ending Story, that was a great part for me.
The part where I didn't make the connection that the dad was the guy in Home Alone until Bailey told me earlier in this podcast.
You played it real cool. I didn't know you didn't know.
I knew him from somewhere. I just couldn't place it.
I was like, I love this guy's face. Where do I know it from?
You watch it, and the cast is such an incredible cast. Like, there's so many huge names in it. And then you realize it's a black and white 28-minute short film. All these people are in this movie. Shelley Duvall is always crazy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I love her.
I was not expecting her haircut.
Yeah.
No.
Shocking.
She had like that a shorter haircut. Version of Watcher in the Woods haircut.
Mm. So I don't know if anybody else was like this or if it was just the effects of COVID, but I actually cried in this short film.
Oh,
it really got me.
What got you
specifically? Wow.
Well, I don't want to ruin it for people, but it was the end after the little boy was saved and then the windmill falls. It just, I mean, we have two dogs, so it was just very emotional.
Oh, sweetie.
Also, it's COVID. This what did you say, COVID season, Eric?
Yeah, quarantine season.
All
this
our
quarantine
emotions.
Season is just packed full of emotions.
Our emotions are all over the place.
Oh, yeah. I will say one COVID reaction from me was the moment where they have all the neighbors in their living room. I'm like, oh, no. Like, I had, like, an immediate reaction, like, oh, that's too many people in a room. I can't do that.
And they're sharing dip.
Oh. They make that scene seem just, like, so catastrophic when, like, yes, literally
it's dog.
Just a little dog running around in the living room.
Poor dog.
Also, can we talk about how, like, all of the chaos and havoc of, like, the neighbors, like, going all, like, torch and pitchfork on these people because of a dog? It's like, the dad literally primed them, like, what you're about to see is a dog. And then a dog came into the room and they're like,
"No!" Oh my god, it's all because
of
the, like,
a dog!
It's all because the alarmist neighbor with the helmet of hair and little dachshund.
Yeah.
It tried to kill my Raymond.
He was nice. He looked like a wolf. Like, what? No.
Well, you know, they made it seem like they were living in a very, like, Pleasantville society.
Yeah, Super and when, Stepford Wives.
It was Super Stepford Wives. And then the neighbors over-exaggerated it. Like, oh, I hear they have a lion in there. Uh-huh. It, yeah. Or, like, it had huge teeth and was trying to kill my little chihuahua.
Well, I love the woman that was hiding behind the chair screaming for dear life.
Yeah.
Like, her life was in imminent danger.
The way that she was screaming and the way the shadow played on her face, it looked like straight out of one of the old horror movies. The way
Night of the Living Dead or something. Yeah, it was great.
That scene did so much to make me angry at them, and during these quarantines, I actually find that I'm angry a lot because I read the news and just, like, it's so tough. But then it made me so happy the way that it ended. Like, yeah. I was so ready to be cynical the whole time and, like, mad at them the whole time. And I even wanted to hold on to it even when they started doing nice things because I was like, y'all guys suck and I just want to dislike you. But then the ending, yeah, like, actually made me feel good. And it was really nice. It was really nice to feel.
I'm really still mad at that guy who lit the windmill on fire because how irresponsible is that guy? Like,
he totally slipped with a Zippo in his hand.
Yeah, right. It was like it was doused in kerosene. It just, like, went up.
It was a miniature golf course made out of paper.
Which are very flammable.
No wonder why it was closed then.
I mean, what I loved about the movie, though, is that what you want out of a good movie is something that's going to really put you on, like, a roller coaster of emotion. And I feel like in 28 minutes, they packed so many roller coasters of emotion from, like, oh, yay, this cute family and her son made a film. This is, like, feeling really good. And then it's, like, all of a sudden you have the scene where the dog's creating all this chaos. And, like, said, there's a mixture of excitement and laughter. And then you're scared whenever the windmill goes up in flames. So you have that, like, what's going to happen? And then the dog saves them. So it's like, oh, that feels so good. And then the townspeople rally around them to, like, support bringing the dog back. Just
a classic.
It's a classic.
It's a classic emotional movie.
It's a classic Tim Burton thing, I think, too, the way how the community and a lot of them comes through. Like in even in Nightmare Before Christmas, I know that one's not directed, it's produced by Tim Burton, right? Even in that one, like, they all come together at the end to save the day, and it's like this community effort. I think the only one that isn't the community effort, yay, gung-ho, everybody at the end, is Edward Scissorhands.
I was just wondering about that one, because I couldn't remember. Like, I don't remember any scenes like that, but it's been so long since I saw it.
Even Beetlejuice is another Tim Burton. They all come together and, like, ends with kind of happy feels.
Yeah.
I was thinking that Edward Scissorhands is the one that has the most parallels to this. Maybe not with the feel-good ending, but, like, this horror, well, first of all, a Frankenstein story that takes place in the suburbs.
Yeah, and just all the, like, paranoia of the suburbs, you know, everyone seems super suspicious.
Yeah, the intolerance.
I thought it was so weird how the neighbor was literally right behind the fence as the kid's taking stuff out of it. It's like, what are you doing watching the neighbor child in and out of his garage? Like, what? Why are you right there?
These people in this, like, wealthy class neighborhood just have nothing better to do but worry about what is going on at the neighbor's house.
Yeah. like, because the mom's like, oh, I got the day off work. So, like, they're clearly, some of them work. But can we just talk about, speaking of, you know, the suburb white picket fence situation, they have a fence with a functioning gate. They have a dog. Why was that gate open? I had such a problem with that. And why was the kid throwing the ball out the gate? Like, I don't understand.
Another thing that I noticed is that when they were trying to reintroduce Sparky to the neighbors and there was the big chaotic scene and Sparky takes off running, it's within about 5 or 10 seconds that every single one of those people now have a flashlight in their hands and are running around with pitchforks down the street trying to chase his dog. Where did all those flashlights come from?
They've just got violence brewing in their hearts, you know?
Also, did anybody dissect the makeup that they did on Sparky after he was resurrected? Because it looked like he had a... kind of a necklace that looked like stitches. He had the little metal plugs somehow stuck to his neck, and then maybe makeup going on his body to make stitches.
Yeah, so like, he had a different butt.
I couldn't get over his butt. I just kept looking like at his butt, and I was like, "What is he have a little blanket like stitched to his butt, or what's going on that?" Like, well, I was so confused on it.
Stitched on.
He got mutilated. You know, he might not have been just one dog anymore.
He's a patchwork dog.
When the car hit him, it did not look like it was a messy situation, but maybe
we didn't actually see. We just saw the car stop.
I mean, he was also buried for a little while. I mean, the worms might have gotten
there. Wasn't it like a day?
That's it.
I thought it was like a day.
Those worms are vicious, man.
How does an 11-year-old kid come up with the science that it's going to take to resurrect a dog?
His science class, the science teacher plugged the dead frog up to electricity, and that's all it takes is just electricity.
Oh, it's just like if you actually read the science textbook, like cover to cover, then you learn how to like resurrect animals.
Yeah.
He does have like 16 books.
What was the part with the fish tank where he's like checking out all the electrical? First of all, I have questions about the integrity of the family's roof.
Yeah, like how did that kid get that swing set on top of the roof?
Yeah, and like the bit that opens up, like what? Then he like looks down and there's a blender and then a fish tank that's like attached to wires. And I was like, is he going to cook the fish with electricity and then transfer their life force into the dog? Like
I have similar questions about the horse toys, like the reindeer toys.
I'd be willing to bet that if you asked Tim Burton like these like pointed questions, he would go, one, the gate has to be open for him to die. Two, it looks cool. Three, I didn't spend a lot of time thinking about it because it's a short film and I didn't have a lot of money. I had to do this under Walt Disney's nose. So
we can all agree that electricity does not really work in a normal way in this universe. Yeah.
I did think it was interesting that the clock ends on 9. Uh-huh. Like, 9's my favorite number, but also Tim Burton has, like, a bunch of other stuff. I wondered if that was an Easter egg that was going through. Because, like, didn't he also do the film 9 about that little guy with, like...
He produced it.
Yeah, and there's something to do with a bunch of numbers in a bunch of his different animated films.
I mean, that was one of my favorite scenes, just because it was so cute and campy. Like, watching this little kid start that bicycle and all these electricity shooting out of the bicycle, then it goes to the rocking horse, then the clock starts spinning around, and it's like it was so campy and you could tell that like he was struggling with budget, but it all worked so well.
One thing that stood out to me a lot was thinking about like his general aesthetic, because I feel like in his early work, I feel like Tim Burton's one of those people that just kind of keeps thinking about the same thing over and over again. And so if you go into his early work, you can see stuff that inspired later stuff. Like that other short that we saw that had the early version of like sandworms and the rocking horses like super reminded me of Nightmare Before Christmas. And so I feel like he just kind of keeps...
And that was the name of the boy in this short as well.
Victor. I said the same thing, Katie.
Great minds, Eric.
It's true.
I did like how the parallels, like, I mean, he was going off of every, I can't remember in the book if the windmill is in the book in Frankenstein, but I know in like every version of the film, they go up in a windmill, the windmill gets lit on fire, the monster goes down with the windmill kind of thing. But then the monster lives.
speaking of the book Frankenstein, has anybody read it?
Not in a long time.
Yeah, like so 10 Kate, years ago.
Well, one of the things I was curious about is it's the electrifying the frog is what starts him thinking about bringing Sparky back. And I was wondering if the frog was in Frankenstein, because I know that there was a scientist that figured out that like the electric currents that run through the body by shocking a frog, and it was like in real life. And this was what led Mary Shelley to write Frankenstein. So I was wondering if it was actually depicted in the book, or they're just drawing on that inspiration in this movie.
I don't remember a frog in the movie. In the book. I feel like the bookends of that one are kind of lost for me because there was so much of Frankenstein's monster wandering around the tundra solipsizing.
Thank you. Yes, that.
Yeah, lots of that.
I feel like that was missing from the movie.
Y'all were talking about comparing it to Vincent. I mean, there's a direct parallel between the dog that he experiments on in Vincent and then Sparky in this. Do y'all remember like some of the other things in Vincent that like the themes that he keeps exploring, like you said, Haley, in this one from Vincent?
I feel like he's just preoccupied with death. Yeah, I don't know. I get also the feeling that he's just kind of wishful thinking, semi-autobiographical. Like, I feel like this is like what he wishes his childhood was.
Yeah, he was filmed down the street from where he used to live.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
He grew up in Southern California?
Apparently he was living in Burbank at the time.
Wow.
Oh, Shelley and the Frog. So apparently twitching frog legs helped inspire Frankenstein. Mm-hmm. Shelley was inspired by the concept of galvanism, the idea that scientists could use electricity to stimulate or restart life, named after Luigi Galvani, an Italian doctor who made a frog's legs twitch when hooked it up to an electric charge.
Was there a mention of that in the book?
I don't think so, if I can remember correctly, too. I don't think there's any mention of the frog in the book.
Right. Well, so the reason I was curious is because Tim Burton, he had rewatched Frankenstein that kind of inspired this, but he didn't, once he decided to make this, he didn't go back and study the movie. He just worked with impressions of the movie. And so like if he had known about the frog thing, because I don't think it's depicted in the Frankenstein movie at all. And I don't think it's in the book either, but it was directly responsible for inspiring the original source material. So does anybody else have any other things that stood out to them?
I thought it was fun that Shelley Duvall was in it. Mary Shelley, Shelley Frankenstein, Shelley Duvall.
Liked the conversation between Shelley Duvall and Shelley Duvall's husband about the fine art paperweight. That was good.
I don't even remember that part.
I liked that too. I felt like the husband, like the dad, was kind of a jerk to her.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. It's like, I don't like him at all. I like Shelley Duvall's character a lot.
Yeah.
Like, he takes a really shitty jab at her where he's like, maybe it was the chicken.
Yeah.
Yeah. I hated that.
That's right.
Seems like it was supposed to play as casual family banter, but like in this day and age, it's just such a cheap shot. I'm like, oh, that sucks.
Yeah.
Not to mention the moment hasn't aged particularly well. When she's like talking to the little girl about like sometimes our imagination just gets the best of us, and her husband just like grabs her and is like, "We must be going now." Like that.
Well, actually, what he says is, "I'm not crazy, even if my daughter is crazy." It's like still that kind of like House on Haunted Hill female hysteria thing. While he's got this shit-eating grin on his face the whole time.
Yes.
I remember in the remake, I think that they made the father much kinder. Am I wrong on that? Like, I remember thinking the dad was like, all right. I was just like, can we just replace Sparky as like not the husband, but can he just be the one that's just hanging out? Like, you know, put a coat on him so we're not bothered by his little butt, and then we'll just call it a day.
No, it's super funny to me how, like, if I had a 10-year-old son and somehow he figured out how to, like, pump a ton of electricity into his dead dog that he unburied and bring him back to life and then, like, tell my parents less than 24 hours later and they're like, oh, my God, this is weird, but we should just tell all the neighbors.
the parents don't react normally.
No one yeah. really reacts normally.
Eric said this earlier, but nobody, none of them like say, wow, I can't believe you brought a dog back from the dead. They're just like,
yeah.
I guess we can't punish him for that.
It's like, wait a second, you're 10 years old. We're dropping you out of school and we're signing you up for MIT.
Yeah, like, right.
Like there was like, there was a moment where the dad said, like, do you understand what this means? And I was like,
yeah,
because the rest of us are sitting here thinking, and that changes the entire course of humanity real quick.
Right, like cut to Nobel Peace Prize ceremony for child.
Yeah. And then the world is just has a bunch of zombies in it. And then we get zombie apocalypse in that universe. Well,
what we didn't see was like right after this 28 minutes, the government and their secret agencies storm this poor kid's house and snatch him and his resurrected dog up and like turn them into science experiments.
At least they could be together.
Yeah, it kind of grossed me out. I had like, I kept thinking too much about what it would be like to dig up a day old decomposed dog.
Honestly, like that dog, it got hit by a car. There was like significant external and internal damage to its body, but it was just fine.
Oh. I was worried at the end that they were going to blow it up with all that power, because that's what actually happened.
Oh, man.
I don't want to make this party a downer, but like a lot of times growing up when we lost a pet, they ended up in like a shoebox in my backyard. Sparky, when he died, he got the full-blown hilltop grave spot with this beautiful cross, and this kid went out there to dig him up. That has to be really traumatic for a 10-year-old. Yeah.
Did y'all notice all the different graves? There was one that said goodbye, Kitty. And then later on the wall of the little girl's room when she's working out with Barbie doing the Jane Fonda workout.
Oh, yeah.
There's a Hello Kitty on her wall.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Really?
I didn't catch that.
I'm pretty sure that the parents were ready for Sparky to go because they were just watching their kid repeatedly throw the ball into the street for the dog to go catch. And they were like, yeah, that's fine.
They hadn't invented helicopter parents yet in the 1950s.
Yeah, they were kids playing on the street. They like didn't think the street was a dangerous place.
We're running out of time. We're going to call it here. Thank you so much for coming, and thank you for watching
the
movie and sharing your thoughts.
Thanks, Bailey.
Yes.
It means a lot to see your faces right now, and I hope everybody that's listening from home is staying safe and healthy. Until then, we have these mini episodes. This has been Memory Static. Return your videos here.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Memory Static. This mini episode was produced by me, Bailey Moore, and edited by me and Janie Moore. The sound clips used are by Cullen Moore, and you can find more of his music on YouTube or Spotify by searching Plaid Tuxedo or by visiting his website at plaidtuxedo.com. Special thanks to Eric Dumig for co-hosting this first mini-series, and to all our Zoom party guests for lending their voices and ideas. I'll have a series of Halloween specials coming your way soon this October, and we are working on ways to complete the regular season before the end of this year. Thanks again for sticking with us. It means a lot, and stay safe out there.